This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The UN humanitarian chief issues a serious warning about the consequences of Israel's ground invasion of Rafah, saying it could lead to a slaughter. South Africa says Israel's ground invasion of Rafah would be a serious breach of the Genocide Convention and ICJ's ruling on the Gaza onslaught. And the Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah says the resistance movement's attacks on Israel will only end once the aggression on the Gaza Strip comes to an end. Israel continues pressing ahead with its bombing campaign in the Gaza Strip, taking the lives of more civilians in the besieged territory. To the south, regime fired artillery at the city of Khan Yunis, cutting off electricity to Al Nasser Hospital, where thousands are sheltering. Israel's ordered people to evacuate from the medical complex, while regime forces continue bombing areas around it. Israeli snipers are also hitting civilians in the hospital courtyard. On Monday, two mosques, as well as an Islamic university in the southern city of Rafah, were also targeted, resulting in dozens of casualties. Nearly 28,500 Palestinians have so far been killed, most of them women and children, since the regime launched its onslaught on Gaza back on October the 7th. And for an update, we're earlier joined from the besieged enclave by Moti Abu Musabe.
The last couple of hours, the Israeli occupation forces intensified their attacks against several areas of Gaza Strip. Despite all eyes are turned into Rafah City, the Israeli occupation forces over the last hour attacked Gaza City relentlessly and intensely. And let me say that as we speak these moments, the Israeli warplanes attacked a residential building in a Zawaida refugee camp, which is located in the surrounding areas of Deir el-Balah city. Apparently, there are multiple Palestinian casualties left behind that attack because the ambulances moved moments ago to the place, to that place where that residential building was attacked by the Israeli warplanes. In Gaza City, as I have just mentioned, that the Israeli warplanes targeted several residential buildings, particularly in Al-Rimal neighborhood and As-Sana'a Square. Multiple residential buildings were flattened over the relentless Israeli airstrikes. In addition to that, several Palestinian civilian cars were also targeted by the Israeli fighter drones, leaving dozens of the Palestinian casualties. At least six Palestinian civilians were killed over those attacks. When it comes to the southern part of Gaza Strip, we are talking about catastrophic conditions when it was about the continuous chronic Israeli airstrikes that hit Rafah City these moments. We are talking about multiple residential buildings were attacked by the Israeli warplanes, leaving dozens of the Palestinian casualties, particularly in the eastern parts of the city. As you know, that even in the north part of the city, the Israeli occupation forces targeted and attacked a group of the Palestinian civilians, including multiple Palestinian journalists, including the Al Jazeera correspondent Ismail Abu Omar. He was critically injured by that attack, and he had his leg amputated over that relentless attack.
Meanwhile, the UN humanitarian chief has sounded the alarm over repercussions of a looming Israeli invasion into Gaza's southern city of Rafah. In a statement, Martin Griffiths said Israel's military push into Rafah, where at least 1.4 million displaced Palestinians are taking shelter, could lead to slaughter. He said the regime cannot ignore recurrent international calls against the dangerous consequences of any such invasion. The UN official also raised concerns over unraveling humanitarian crisis in the city, saying the assault against Palestinians there is unparalleled in intensity, brutality, and scope. The UN humanitarian chief said any ground invasion will lead to immediate cessation of the already fragile humanitarian operation there. And earlier on Tuesday, head of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, expressed concerns over the situation as well, saying there is absolutely no safe place in Rafah.
We were talking about the situation in Rafah, which is deeply, deeply concerning. And as you know, people are anxious and in fear of a possible large-scale military operation. If this military operation is taking place, the question is, where will the civilian go? There is absolutely no safe place in Rafah anymore, and the fear is that the number of people killed and injured might again significantly increase.
Philippe Lazzarini made the comments after meeting with the UN member states in Geneva. He added, what is impossible is to expect over a million displaced people crammed into Rafah to once again move. Lazzarini also slammed calls to dismantle UNRWA, warning about the impact of the move. Israel's accused 12 UNRWA employees of helping Hamas in its October 7th operation without providing any evidence. However, the allegation alone prompted the regime's Western backers to suspend their funding of the agency. UN aid agency warned that it will have to cease its vital services by the end of the month. South Africa has submitted an urgent request to the International Court of Justice to examine if Israel's planned assault on Rafah in southern Gaza breaches the court's orders. The South African government has, in a statement, said that it was gravely concerned that the unprecedented military offensive against Rafah has already led to and will result in further large-scale massacres. A statement also added any ground invasion will be a serious and irreparable breach of the Genocide Convention and the court's order of January 26. Last month, the Hague-based court announced its provisional ruling in a case brought by South Africa against Israel. The World Court called on Israel to cease all activities that would constitute genocide against Palestinians living in Gaza. And people throughout the world continue to hold rallies and marches to express anger at Israel's ongoing campaign of genocide in Gaza. Hundreds of Spaniards once again hit the streets of Madrid to denounce their government for arming the Israeli regime.
If the government is not going to do anything for Palestine, at least keep your mouth shut. Stay put and don't sell arms to Israel. Don't be complicit and help kill Palestinian children. They killed all the children. There's no one left.
Protesters gathered in front of the Foreign Ministry building on Monday. They slammed Israeli offensive in the southern Gaza and called for a boycott of the regime. Some of them held Palestinian flags and chanted slogans saying Israel is a terrorist state. People in the Canadian cities of Vancouver and Toronto also took to the streets in solidarity with Palestinians. They chanted hands off Rafah in reference to Israeli threats to invade the southern city.
An emergency protest outside the UK Prime Minister's office to try and stop an imminent massacre, called for by the Palestine Solidarity Campaign and a coalition of other similar organizations.
Week after week, pro-Palestinian protesters have come out in huge numbers to demand that the British government call for a permanent, immediate ceasefire in the Gaza Strip and to terminate its military and political support for apartheid Israel. And they're galvanized by the knowledge and hope that the pressure they're ramping up on the British government will eventually stir action.
In a sign of that pressure working, only hours before the protests, the UK's Foreign Secretary David Cameron joined other European leaders to caution the Netanyahu regime to think twice about its mass incursion into the southern Gaza city of Rafah, which shelters 1.4 million displaced Palestinians.
We are very concerned about the situation, and we want Israel to stop and think very seriously before it takes any further action. But above all, what we want is an immediate pause in the fighting, and we want that pause to lead to a ceasefire, a sustainable ceasefire, without a return to further fighting.
Hands off Gaza!
Hands off Gaza!
Hands off Gaza!
But while that may seem like a change in the UK government's tone, the protesters here say it doesn't go far enough.
What kind of disturbed and dystopian world are we in? We're asking for peace is become slander. I just do not understand. I cannot comprehend what more needs to be done. Do they need to see 1 million Gazans being exterminated on their TVs or drowning in the Mediterranean Sea? Because that is the options that Israel is giving them.
Another demand here, an end to UK arms sales to Israel. According to the Campaign Against the Arms Trade, between 2015 and 2022, the UK licensed more than $500 million worth of weapons to Tel Aviv.
Our UK government should be having no trade with Israel, let alone arms trade, let alone trading equipment that kills Palestinians.
The fourth national demonstration of the year is planned for February 17th. Organizers say they're expecting hundreds of thousands to turn out to hold the British government's feet to the fire. Saeed Purza, London.
On Tuesday, lawmakers from the opposition parties held a flash mob outside Italy's lower house calling for a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. The protest was staged while the Chamber of Deputies was voting on six different motions on the ongoing West Asia crisis. Some lawmakers from the once anti-establishment five-star movement, the Italian Left and Green Europe parties and the Democratic Party, gathered in Parliament Square shouting out loud that the Israeli bombardment of Gaza must stop now.
I think it's time that we place our attention on what's going on in the overcrowded Rafah, where the Israeli bombardments are ongoing. Nearly 30,000 Gazans have been killed. This is nothing less than a collective punishment, period.
At the end of Tuesday's vote, only a very weak motion was passed by the lower house. The approved motion doesn't acknowledge Israel's genocide and doesn't condemn the regime for its crimes. It even confirms Italy's suspension of funding to the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA.
International law must be enforced. After 40 years of UN resolutions, Israel must now comply. It's time to recognize Palestine as a state, first and foremost.
Meanwhile, the bulk of Italy's mainstream media continues to aid and abet Israel's massacre in Gaza, marginalizing Palestinian voices. At the weekend, during a national song contest which brings tens of millions of viewers together, a rapper called for a stop to Israeli genocide during his appearance on stage. The aftermath saw a flurry of condemnations by pro-Israel figures, including the Israeli ambassador to Italy, which led to apologize from the national TV broadcaster management.
Artists should be free to say what they think, and journalists must be able to do their job. Embassies should not meddle in our internal affairs. We must stop the ongoing massacre in Gaza. That's it.
Protests against national broadcaster Rai's decision to apologize to Israel have been held in Naples and Turin over the past days. During these protests, clashes between pro-Palestine activists and the police have led to several injuries and arrests. Max Civili, Rome.
The Hezbollah leader says the Lebanese resistance movement will stick to its anti-Israel operations until the aggression on Gaza comes to an end. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah said it's a moral duty and strategic interest for Lebanon. Now, he made these remarks in a televised speech in response to criticism that the movement's anti-Israel operations could endanger Lebanon. He argued a weak Israel will benefit the entire region while a strong one will pose a greater threat. He said if the regime emerges victorious in the Gaza war, it may decide to invade Lebanon again, as it did in the 1980s. Nasrallah said Israel only understands the language of force since it does not respect international resolutions. The Hezbollah leader also touched on a flurry of visits by Western delegations to Lebanon. He said their only purpose is to give security guarantees for Israel so settlers could return to their homes and areas along the Lebanese border.
all of these delegations which came, which brought with them proposals and ideas and suggestions and mechanisms, they all come with one goal, which is Israel's security, protecting Israel. Stop attacking the Israeli positions, the Israeli bases.
Nasrallah said delegations are not acting as mediators, but rather they're presenting Israel's proposals as their own and expect Hezbollah to accept them. He said the Western delegations are not even ready to help Lebanon retrieve its territories occupied by Israel. Nasrallah said the Israeli enemy is not in a position to impose any conditions on Lebanon. The 28th meeting of G5 countries on health cooperation is underway in the Iranian capital, Tehran. Representatives from Iran, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Tajikistan, along with the World Health Organization, will be discussing technical issues pertaining to women's health. They also share experiences and explore areas of cooperation. Gisumi Shahmadi takes us there.
Addressing women's health challenges and how they may affect the family, and particularly young children. Iran, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Tajikistan, along with the WHO, coming together for the 28th time since 2005 to promote regional cooperation, an initiative by the Islamic Republic of Iran to improve public healthcare services.
Regional and sub-regional partnerships are crucial for effective implementation of joint regional initiatives and cross-border collaboration, and for detecting and responding to disease outbreaks and other man-made and natural disasters.
The challenges discussed in this three-day meeting will provide the groundwork for a much larger international health conference dubbed PAC for UHC, or Primary Healthcare for Universal Health Coverage, to be held right here in March.
This is the eighth time during Mr. Raisi's term in office that the G5 meeting is held. The main objective is to pinpoint the challenges that exist so that we can plan the upcoming PHC for UHC conference. The health sector of Iran has improved to a level where it can not only become a health tourism hub, but also share its valuable experiences with regional countries and help with improving health issues.
And while neighboring countries are dealing with a number of issues, they still could not turn a blind eye to the tragic situation of mothers and children in Gaza, living in dreadful conditions, now struggling to access safe water and sanitation, a basic human right.
G5 Forum basically provides us an opportunity to learn from the weaknesses, from the challenges, and take a comparative disadvantage of each other from our strengths and experiences.
The ultimate goal is to provide universal health coverage and develop national roadmaps and strategies for improving healthcare services. Iran's initiative in this regard has allowed major advancements, and according to the World Health Organization, the Islamic Republic of Iran is now a role model, with its PAC, or Primary Healthcare Network, extending beyond its borders.
These meetings will continue until February 15th, with the participants discussing the different challenges that they're facing, also paving the way for an international health conference that will be held in the Iranian capital in March. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the Limelight. A record number of children and young people in England are seeking help for mental health problems. We take a look at some of the press and world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. According to data laying bare the impact of lengthy waiting lists for regular National Health Service treatment, the number of children referred to emergency mental health care in England has soared by more than 50% in 3 years. Analysis of official data by the Royal College of Psychiatrists revealed there were 32,521 emergency and urgent referrals to child and adolescent mental health services crisis teams in 2022-2023. In 2019-2020, the year before the COVID pandemic, the figure was 21,242. The increase means more than 600 mentally ill children a week are deteriorating to such a state that they need reach a crisis point. The college said many of the children requiring emergency care, some suicidal or seriously ill as a result of eating disorders, have been stuck on waiting lists for an average of 5 months, and in the worst cases, as long as 2 years. British MPs and health leaders said the National Health Service figures expose a devastating explosion of untreated severe mental ill health among children and should be a wake-up call for the government. They added there was now a serious risk that the alarming surge in children reaching crisis point before being able to access help was becoming the new norm. The president of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, Dr. Lade Smith, told The Guardian no one should have to watch their child's mental health deteriorate while they wait for care, adding, "It's completely unacceptable that this is the reality facing so many families." Dr. Lade Smith said ministers must take urgent action to provide targeted support to every child in need of mental health care and turn the tide on the country's growing children's mental health crisis. She added, "We want to provide young people with effective care as soon as they need it, not once they've already developed a serious illness which could have been prevented. That's why we need to see government focus on prevention and reversing the rising rates of mental illness, as well as ensuring sufficient resources of specialist services." The British newspaper The Sun has also covered the same story and tells us more. Record numbers of children and young people in England are seeking help for mental health problems. In 2022 alone, 1.4 million were referred to child and adolescent mental health services for treatment of anxiety, depression, eating disorders and other psychological problems. But as demand soars for children's mental health care and support, the child and adolescent mental health services teams are struggling to see or treat children quickly enough. Experts say that is leading to thousands of under-18s getting even sicker while on waiting lists, prompting a 53% rise in emergency and urgent referrals for child and adolescent mental health services crisis care. An emergency referral is normally made if a child needs to be seen within 24 hours. Experts say they might be at risk to themselves due to suicidal feelings, have a significant health risk because of an illness such as anorexia, or have another serious mental health condition. Emergency referrals to child and adolescent mental health services are mostly made by general practitioners and doctors in accidents and emergency departments, which are seeing rising numbers of mentally ill children arrive with nowhere else to turn, although schools and social services can also do so. Dr. Elaine Lockhart, the chair of the college's child and adolescent faculty, said, "It's unacceptable that so many children and young people are reaching crisis point before they're able to access care. We cannot allow this to become the new norm." Dr. Elaine Lockhart said, "Severe mental illness is not just an adult problem. The need for specialist mental health services for children and young people is growing all the time." She added, "Many of the conditions arising in children could be prevented or treated if prompt support and access to care were available." Dr. Elaine Lockhart noted, "The evidence shows us that children who receive support quickly are less likely to develop long-term conditions that negatively affect their education, social development, and health in later life. Government and integrated care boards must commit to reducing the rate of mental illness among children by setting an achievable target. This needs to be backed by an expansion of the mental health workforce and additional funding for services." The college welcomed last year's government announcement of an extra £5 million to improve access to early support hubs for people aged between 11 and 25, but it said an extra £125 million to £205 million would be needed to establish hubs in every local authority, with running costs of at least £114 million a year. Laura Bunt, the chief executive of Young Minds, a child's mental health charity, said, "Every young person should be able to access the help they need when they need it. The government must prioritize young people's mental health and make it much easier for them to get support." Daisy Cooper, MP, the Liberal Democrat health spokesperson, said, "This devastating explosion of mental ill health among children should be a wake-up call for the government. Conservative ministers have neglected children's mental health during and after the pandemic, leaving mental health services and families in crisis." British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. A charity cautioned a worrying number of people taking time off work due to poor mental health leaves the United Kingdom at risk of becoming a burnt-out nation. The head of Mental Health UK has suggested global issues such as climate change and artificial intelligence fueling feelings of hopelessness could be contributing to burnout. It comes after a survey revealed more than a third of adults faced extreme pressure in the workplace in the past year. The YouGov opinion poll of 2,060 adults, 1,132 of whom were workers, found 35% had experienced high or extreme levels of pressure at work, with 20% requiring time off due to poor mental health caused by stress in the past year. Mental Health UK's chief executive, Brian Dow, warned the United Kingdom was rapidly becoming a burnt-out nation, with a worrying number of people taking time off work due to poor mental health caused by stress. He added, "High levels of work absence due to poor mental health are a major challenge, but its causes are complex." He continued by saying, "Public attitudes and understanding towards mental health and work have changed, particularly as the workplace transformed overnight in response to the pandemic." Dow stated, "Meanwhile, we live in unprecedented times and life outside of work has become increasingly difficult due to the cost of living crisis and pressures on public services. While global challenges such as climate change and artificial intelligence fuel stress, anxiety and feelings of hopelessness." Dow called on the government to intervene and better support the workforce. He advocated for a national conversation on the issue. Mental Health UK urged Prime Minister Rishi Sunak to hold a national summit to bring together ministers, employers and experts in an effort to create a healthy workplace and better support for workers.
Food for thought.
Hello, everyone, and our heartiest congratulations to all. Today, on the auspicious birth anniversary of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, the younger grandson of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, let us listen to a gem of a saying from the immortal martyr of Karbala. By my life, what is the Imam except the one who judges by the book, who upholds justice, who professes the religion of truth, and who devotes himself to the will of Allah?
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the significance of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z. Dear listeners, this is Ali, and in today's episode of A to Z, we want to talk about the Islamic Revolution that took place in Iran. And also at the same time, we want to look and inspect who Imam Khomeini was, the founder of the Islamic Revolution. There are some critical questions that we have been trying to address through these series of episodes of A to Z, and those questions are very critical that need to be thought through by every single individual out there. See, we live in 21st century where we have curiosity about so many different topics and subjects that one cannot even fathom and one cannot even imagine. The curiosity level of human beings has raised to a level which is unprecedented. But what we're saying is that in addition to your curiosities, what you need to be thinking and you must be asking is what this Islamic Revolution accomplished and how did it happen and what did it bring to the people? Who was Imam Khomeini? Why is he still talked about? What were the factors that distinguished Imam Khomeini as a personality from other reformers of the past and the present? What is it that makes the Islamic Revolution truly unique when you compare it to other revolutions that have taken place? So, brothers and sisters, in order to understand and answer these questions, we need to be inspecting and we need to be studying what the Islamic Revolution was all about. What is, if you allow, the term Khomeiniism? Khomeiniism is something that needs to be understood by the world today. Imam Khomeini did not believe in compromising, brothers and sisters. He's the founder of the Islamic Revolution, right? He did not believe in compromising on principles, those human principles. Though he could have easily sided with one superpower to counter the materialistic imperialism of the other, he instead challenged the two prevailing superpowers of his time, namely the Soviets and America.
Welcome back, dear listeners.
So Imam Khomeini did not side with America, or he did not side with Russia. He said, we reject both of these systems, which are actually heads-on at that time. Keep in mind, like if you go back in history, these two systems, they were going through a power struggle. Imam Khomeini, instead, he raised a different slogan. He said, La Sharqiya, La Gharbiya, Islamiya, Islamiya. That we're not going to go with the East, that is, the Russia or Soviets. We're not going to go with the West, which is America. We're going to go with Islam. Islam is our choice. Islam is the criteria. Islam is our foundation. This is who Imam Khomeini was. He challenged these two prevailing superpowers of that time who were going through that power struggle. He stood his ground as a matter of principle. Brothers and sisters, Khomeiniism is not about maintaining a cult of personality like Stalinism or Maoism. That is what the critiques of the revolution would have us believe. Brothers and sisters, Khomeiniism, in fact, is about standing for truth, standing for Haq. It is about resisting the oppressor and supporting the oppressed, and no compromises whatsoever. There are two types of ulama. There are two types of scholars. One is the ulama-i Haq and ulama-i Su. This is the other category. The ulama that are on the Haq, they are on the side of truth. And then there are scholars who are on the side of falsehood. Okay? Now, Imam Khomeini, in contemporary times, was that beacon of light for all of the scholars of Haq and truth. So for now, we leave you in Allah's care, and thank you for listening to today's show.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Instead of stones.
Part 2.
Tehran's ties with the Palestinian resistance groups developed steadily, even when the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein waged one of the bloodiest and longest wars in the region against Iran. Iran's closer cooperation with the Palestinian groups began in 1987 after Israel expelled Hamas and Islamic Jihad leaders to Lebanon as part of its efforts to suppress the Palestinian national leadership in the occupied Gaza Strip and the West Bank. The raging war against Iran failed to distract the nation from the Palestinian cause. The Islamic Republic expressed its deep disagreements over the so-called Reagan peace plan and the Fahd peace plan, where the rights of the Palestinians have been almost totally ignored in favor of the Israeli regime. Inspired partly by the Islamic Revolution, in December 1987, the Palestinian people staged a sustained series of protests, civil disobedience, and riots, which later came to be known as the First Intifada, or the Stone Intifada, as they were still throwing stones at Israeli soldiers who were armed to the teeth. Amid the deafening silence of Arab leaders, Tehran lent all its support to the Palestinian cause. Imam Khomeini took a clear, strong stance, saying with the Israeli regime in place, the Palestinians would not see the end of their sufferings. In 1993, Fatih Shaghari told Newsday, "Iran gives us money and supports us. Then we supply the money and arms to the occupied territories and support the families of our people." To draw further attention to the pain and suffering of the Palestinian people, a couple of years after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Iranian pilgrims began staging demonstrations against Israel and its major supporter, the United States, at the Hajj. Perhaps one thing that sparked the flames of the First Intifada was a tragic incident that happened that year in Mecca, Saudi Arabia. On July 31st, 1987, during one of these pro-Palestinian demonstrations, the clash between Iranian demonstrators and Saudi security forces turned bloody, resulting in the deaths of more than 400 pilgrims. Hamas, an acronym in Arabic for Islamic Resistance Movement, emerged out of the First Palestinian Intifada in 1987. It was co-founded by Sheikh Ahmed Yassin and six others, originally as a local offshoot of Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood. On May 2, 1998, Hamas, still a fledgling group with less than a decade since its formation, paid a visit to Tehran to meet the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. The meeting happened when almost none of the leaders of the Arab world took the Palestinian Intifada seriously. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, however, had a different opinion about the struggle, the group, and its leader, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin. Iran pledged financial support and provided the group with advanced military training at bases belonging to the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps in Iran and Lebanon. It also trained Palestinian engineers to manufacture weapons locally. The Second Palestinian Intifada erupted in September 2000, after the collapse of the so-called Middle East peace talks at Camp David and Ariel Sharon's unlawful visit to Haram al-Sharif, the home of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the third holiest site in Islam. It was a major uprising by the Palestinians against the Israeli occupation that continued for 5 years. In 2006, Hamas won a huge majority in parliamentary elections, with Palestinian voters giving the group 76 seats in parliament out of the 132 seats available. After the Hamas victory, Khalid Mash'al visited Tehran and said, "Just as Islamic Iran defends the rights of the Palestinians, we defend the rights of Islamic Iran. We are part of a united front against the enemies of Islam." Unlike some other Palestinian groups, Hamas never recognized the occupation regime. So following the group's takeover of Gaza, a crippling blockade was imposed on the Strip to limit the movement of the people and goods, a collective punishment for electing an uncompromising group. To put more pressure, the U.S. and its allies imposed sanctions on Hamas and the community the group represented. Many in the Arab world left the group high and dry, but the Islamic Republic, an all-weather friend, never withdrew its support for the group in the hardest of times. The Shia state gave a hand to the Sunni group, to remind the Muslim world that Palestine transcends sectarian differences. On March 9, 2008, a Hamas senior commander, interviewed by the Sunday Times, said 300 of the group's best brains had been secretly sent to Tehran. According to the commander, who wished to remain anonymous, half are still being trained by the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. They're learning how to make explosives from everyday items and produce more effective rockets. The rest have already returned from the IRGC base in Tehran. Some have been trained as snipers. Others have learned to use tunnels and attacks on Israeli forces. Iran is our mother. She gives us information, military supplies, and financial support. The resistance movement in Palestine built up steam when Lieutenant General Haj Qasem Soleimani took the helm of Iran's Quds Force, one of the IRGC's branches with its main focus on assisting resistance groups in the region. Thanks to Tehran's unwavering support, resistance groups in Palestine grew strong enough to deal the hardest blows on the Israeli regime, something unimaginable after the Six-Day War. For the Palestinians, time for lopsided defeat had gone, and for the Israelis, victory was no longer for granted. Subsequent wars, like the one in 2012, left no doubt that the Palestinians had risen from the ashes. During a visit by Hamas leaders to Iran in 2019, Ayatollah Khamenei stated, "Not many years ago, the Palestinians fought against Israel with stones. But today, instead of stones, they're equipped with precision missiles. This signifies development." Struggle against the occupation regime reached its crescendo in October 7, 2023, when Hamas forces launched a land, air, and sea attack into the heart of the Israeli occupation territories, catching the enemy off guard and shattering its myth of invincibility in spite of all its state-of-the-art weapons and its huge military expenditure. Iran was not involved in the attack, but who can deny the country's decades-long support that molded drone flyers out of the stone-throwing fighters?
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The British Army has come under scrutiny for its inability to hire people at all levels of service. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Telegraph has covered this story and tells us more. A leaked document revealed the British Army wants to relax security checks it runs on overseas recruits in an effort to solve the growing staffing crisis. Understood to be the latest guidance, the internal policy document leaked to the British Daily outlines a series of actions that aim to boost falling personnel numbers and cause security clearance the primary barrier to non-UK personnel gaining a commission in the army. Vetting is a standard part of the process of becoming an officer in the British Army and included counter-terrorism checks. Security clearance is described as being the most common type of vetting process and determines that a person's character and personal circumstances are such that they can be trusted to work in a position that involves long-term, frequent, and uncontrolled access to secret assets. The 5-year period being a UK resident needed to gain security clearance was described as prohibitive to overseas recruits applying for officer and intelligence roles. The leaked document noted that the Army struggles to attract talent from ethnic minority backgrounds into the officer corps. It said that while people from Commonwealth countries can serve in the British Army, just 135 officers from overseas are currently serving in the British Armed Forces. Of these, just 28 are recorded as being from ethnic minority backgrounds, while the rest are white Irish or white Commonwealth. A group of former army officials have since signed a letter to the UK's Defence Minister, Grant Shapps, calling the updated policy dangerous madness. The army has come under scrutiny for its inability to hire people at all levels of service, outsourcing giant Capita, which is in charge of recruitment for the army, recommended that it should ditch or loosen restrictions on hiring soldiers with tattoos and those with a history of asthma to solve its recruitment crisis. The firm told the Defence Select Committee inquiry into the recruitment of youngsters that many were waiting 150 days to join the army, partly caused by the medical assessments they have to undertake. Its representatives told MPs that would-be recruits were being attracted elsewhere as the time taken to be accepted was so long that they were finding other jobs in the meantime, amid ominous warnings that the Army, Navy and Marines are all hemorrhaging troops faster than they can be recruited. A top US general also warned that the UK's shrinking army is not what it used to be. A former senior US general has said that while the United Kingdom was still seen as America's closest ally, it was also seen as having diminished capabilities over the past couple of decades. They added, "Hence, while being the most important ally across the board, it is decidedly not what it used to be, regrettably. Based on the current trends, the Army will have just 52,000 troops in 10 years' time." In a 1-year period up to September of last year, the Army's strength plummeted from 79,139 to 75,983, as more soldiers left than started. The website, the Defense Post, has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to government figures, almost 30,000 British troops from across the armed forces are medically unfit for combat operations due to physical injuries and mental health issues. The problem is greatest in the Army, where only 53,000 troops out of a total of around 75,000 personnel are currently fully fit for frontline operations. That means that 30% of all troops in the Army, or 3 in 10 soldiers, would not be fully fit to fight in a conflict now. The injury crisis will heap further pressure on the new Defence Secretary Grant Shapps, following the disclosure that all 3 services are significantly under strength. According to numbers released by the Ministry of Defence, the MOD, overall 28,664 personnel across all 3 of the armed forces are currently not fully fit for combat. While some of those could deploy overseas in an emergency as part of a large force, many would not be able to take part in combat missions or even leave a secure base because they have been medically downgraded. Recently, the Defence Post revealed the recruitment crisis is forcing the Royal Navy to decommission 2 warships, Westminster and Argyle, so that the new class of Type 26 frigates can be staffed. According to the Ministry of Defence, the Army is currently composed of around 74,110 personnel, but only 53,192 are fit for operations, or what the military calls medically fully deployable. A Freedom of Information document obtained by this newspaper reveals that 9,217 soldiers are classified as medically limited deployable, meaning that they can deploy on operations but will only be able to conduct certain duties. A further 7,449, almost 1 in 10 of all soldiers, cannot be deployed at all and are classified as medically non-deployable. Comparisons with the number of injured troops from July of 2021 appear to show that the problem is getting worse. In July of 2021, there were 13,248 troops across the armed forces classified as non-deployable. But by July of 2023, the latest figures available show that the number had grown to 14,743. A further 7,921 personnel were classed as being of limited deployability. The classification means that they have either a persistent but relatively minor injury, such as a back problem, or an injury that is close to recovery, such as ligament damage. According to government figures, there are 29,220 personnel serving in the Royal Navy and Royal Marines, while a further 29,010 personnel serving in the Royal Air Force. But Ministry of Defence figures show that there are currently just 21,649 fully fit sailors in the Navy, while the Royal Air Force has just 19,466 fit personnel. The Freedom of Information request reveals that across the armed forces, 13,727 troops have been downgraded from frontline duties because of musculoskeletal injuries suffered in training or from combat, but the document also shows 4,214 troops cannot deploy on combat operations